Journalist Hannah Rosen's new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women, has sparked a lot of debate. Not surprisingly. The title's like a slap upside the head. A wake-up call in case you thought the familiar gender lines of America were etched in stone. But it's also more complex than that. Rosen says the numbers were part of what clued her in to a social sea change.
I began this research in 2009, which was when women became the majority of the workforce. Now they hover around 50%. That's a huge development in American history and world history. If you think about how we think of men and women and their roles in the world and in society and women in the private sphere and men in the public sphere, so that's actually is quite a big change. I write about the economy as what I call a traveling sisterhood, which means as more women enter at the top, lawyers, doctors, accountants, they open up jobs for women at the bottom to do the things that women and usually wives used to do for free. So childcare, elder care, food preparation, a lot of service industry jobs. So those are some of the changing numbers. And colleges and universities is where it's incontrovertible. You have a lot more female graduates than male graduates. And you also have a world in which it's extremely difficult to have a successful middle-class life without a college degree. It's not impossible, but it's so much harder than it was 20 years ago.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because if women are now 50% of the workplace, and it makes sense if they're 51% of the population that they should be 50% of the workplace, it's still true, isn't it, that women's pay still averages, what, 20% less than men's?
So that's such a complicated issue, the wage gap. I mean, I don't claim in the book that women, you know, make as much money as men and that we solved all the problems, because you'd have to be an idiot or a liar to do that. I do live in Washington, where you can see that, you know, Congress is dominated by men. A lot of companies are dominated by men. I guess the interesting question is, what are the underlying structural changes? What's the trajectory we're headed on? Is there any reason to believe that this is a permanent state, or are we moving really towards a new state? And so, yes, there are lots and lots and lots of problems to figure out. In the workplace, they generally have to do with the idea that we don't acknowledge what it is I'm describing anthropologically. So we still have a workplace, not just in the U.S., but in many places in the world, that assumes that one person's always at home and the other person is available to work infinitely. That's how workplaces are set up. And so women are at a comparative disadvantage because, in fact, they do still carry the burden of childcare. So, you know, there's not an I won feeling to my book, even though that's how it's often interpreted, not at all. I mean, you read the stories of these women and you think, well, the matriarchy doesn't sound so great because here's a lot of women going it alone. And even at the top levels of society, when women are married, they're exhausted. You know, they feel like they have to work twice as hard still to earn as much as a man. So it's not triumphalist. It's just a set of changes, both economic and social, which is leading to a quite different world that we live in. But it's not, you know, yay, we won.
You start with a woman you ran into who is anything but. You ran into her grocery cart in the store. She and her daughter were sharing granola bars, as I remember.
Yes. We live in an extremely class-divided society, as we all know. So the phenomenon I'm describing looks very different at the top, which is, frankly, all anyone wants to talk about. But it looks very, very different at the top than it does for people who don't have college degrees. And so, yes, I start this book talking about a town that's a mostly working-class town where I'd been going for many years. And one year I noticed that there just didn't seem to be any men around. It was like a sort of ghost town, only women, like that TV show, you know, when the women disappear, but in opposite. And I bumped into a woman, and being a nosy reporter, I started to ask her a lot of questions. You know, here's your daughter, you know, where's her father? And turns out they weren't married. And then she said this phrase to me, which I since heard so many times in my reporting, which is quite insulting, but essentially talking about her husband, rather her boyfriend, big mistake, like he was just another mouth to feed. You know, the reason he wasn't part of their life and living in their family is because he was basically just another mouth to feed. And that's when I started to get a hint of things really having turned upside down, of women really embodying this role of provider and head of the family, and men sort of dropping out of society in a way.
Well, I don't want to jump to the end of the book either, but it seems to me important to talk about Bethany's not husband, Kelvin, because you actually had quite a long relationship with him too.
I did. I kept in touch with him. I asked her for his phone number. You know, I talked to him. I was thinking about, when I first got into this, I was thinking about what was going on with men. I mean, Susan Faludi had written her book Stiffed in 2000 about basically what happened to men after all these recessions. And I was thinking, wow, we've even had more recessions. They've been pummeled even more. So where are they now? And so that's what I was initially thinking of writing about. And so that's why I developed this relationship with this man, Calvin, and became interested in him as well as his girlfriend, and helped him find a job and watched him evolve and basically stumble around and not be able to find himself. And lo and behold, I called him at the very end of the process of writing the book, and it turned out he had finally found himself, and he had gotten into a terrible car accident, and this really had shaken him up, and he decided that he was going to try and become a nurse. Now, I really couldn't have written a better ending for myself. You know, I couldn't have made up a better story, except to find this guy who, you know, it took him a few years, but he sort of came to terms with what we might call the feminized economy, was kind of putting in his papers. Now, I have to say, I thought this was a really heartwarming story, but as often happens when you write a book, you don't really know how it's going to be received. You only know how you felt it. And his story has not been received entirely well by most people. Most people read that story and think, so are you saying that men have to become women and that's the only way out of this?
Is it possible even to talk about gender identities as something that should change? Because that's in some ways what you're talking about. I mean, men and women can and do change diapers with equal skill. Well, some.
I think that the place, some of them do. I think more and more do, though. I mean, we can say that, you know, fathers of every social class, those standards have changed. I mean, it's, you know, our expectations are of a father are very different than they were when I was growing up. I think where I've concluded in the end, the place that I feel comfortable is not to say, you know, men are like this, women are like this, but that in a changing economy and a changing society, there are traits that are traditionally feminine that seem to serve people well and that people value both in the workplace and in the home. There are traditionally masculine traits, and that we can sort of pick and choose from those traits. You know, that you know, women, I write a lot about when I address women at the top and the question of why women, there aren't more women CEOs. I write about this dance that women have to do around power and our general discomfort with female power and how they have to present themselves as, you know, sort of powerful, competent, confident without making people think they're unfeminine. You know, so it's like you're picking and choosing a little bit from this menu and a little bit from that menu. It's complicated, but, you know, in each era we value different things. And the same is true for men. So you don't have to become a woman, but there are certain traits that it might be useful to pick up, like adaptability or flexibility or traits that seem to serve people well in this economy.
What makes this a powerful story is that we have to look at where we've been and where we're going. Now, I have a son in his 30s. And a grandson who just turned 5, and I'm going to have to worry about what their future is. I know you have sons who are just out of elementary school into middle school, maybe.
I have a 4-year-old and a 9-year-old boy. My daughter is sort of just into middle school. And the 9-year-old boy to whom I dedicate this book is very offended by the title of the book. You know, he's at an age where he's learning about bullying and, you know, he just thinks it's mean, which it is mean. And so I've had to think about that a lot, you know. So what message am I putting out there and what is it I could say to him? You know, I know in my own head what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when he grows up and he decides, say, that he wants to work 4 days a week or take his kids to the playground on a Tuesday afternoon or ask something of his boss, you know, that makes it obvious that he would like to spend more time taking care of his children, that should not be a big deal, that no one should think there's anything wrong with him or anything different about him. Nobody should write a book about him. You know, nobody should interview him for an article on stay-at-home dads, which people still seem to do. It should just be normal. And I actually think that's better, because one thing I've become painfully aware of while reporting this book is that our restrictions on men are quite narrow. That, you know, over the course of the century, we don't actually allow men kind of a wide range of movement the way we allow women. I mean, women have changed so much how they behave in the public sphere, whether they work with small children, how they dress, how they talk about sex. I mean, we really have changed a lot, whereas men have changed, you know, much more slowly.
I suppose the argument is that women have had so much demanded of them that they've had a lot of room they had to change, whereas men have had so much offered to them. Listen, I'm not making this argument. I'm just trying to understand the issue.
I think that is part of it. I mean, part of it is that the marginalized are more adaptable generally. So when I say I have this concept of the plastic woman and the cardboard man, you know, to describe what I just said, this idea that women are more flexible and have had to play many different roles over the course of the century, whereas men have been in a narrower box and not quite as flexible or adaptable. And I think largely that's because they haven't had to be. So in my chapter on Alabama, when I write about this factory town in which the factory closed down and men and women were trying to sort of find their place and support their families in this new world, and you listen to the men and you think there's a whole host of jobs that are just off limits to them because the jobs aren't considered manly, you know? And you can have two reactions to that. You can judge them for that, or you can say, you know, you're asking something very difficult of them. They've had everything handed to them in a sense. They've had a life sort of set up for them. They've had a certain set of privileges where the women are kind of scrambling and moving from the bottom up. And that's always more fun than going from the top down, you know?
What do you think this means for families? We've already seen that marriage seems less important to many people than it used to be. What does this mean in terms of how you raise your children? I mean, you've already begun to talk to your sons about what they're going to be. How do you change the nuclear family to adapt to a new and different Western society?
Well, it's already meant very different things for different kinds of families. And so for college-educated families, we have actually had quite strong marriages lately. And I mean that statistically. I don't mean that judgmentally. Like, fewer people getting divorced who are college-educated, more people defining their marriages as happy, very few children born to single mothers. You know, the upper-class elites have become kind of the standard-bearers of happy marriages. And I think that's because of the changes that I describe. So it's related to the fact that nobody feels trapped the way they did, say, in 1962 in one role or another. So the woman is not trapped in the home the way she felt in the feminine mystique era.
Give people more freedom and they feel less trapped, of course.
Yeah, they feel less trapped. And so, and that's the best guess about, you know, I call these the seesaw marriages, which means that, you know, the woman could be the breadwinner for a while, like take the Obamas. You know, Michelle Obama is a healthcare executive. She earns a lot of money while Barack Obama's a lawyer and, you know, working in public service. And then now she's the first lady supporting him. Like, you can trade places and that makes for a less oppressive situation. Whereas for the non-college educated, I mean, marriage rates are plummeting and rates of single mother are soaring, and it's a completely different picture. This is what I call the new American matriarchy, and it's not good. You know, it's not a triumph at all. It basically means women working really hard, you know, like the woman I described, Bethany, in the introduction to the book, working, going to college, getting a degree, raising children by themselves, and the men kind of dropping out of the picture, which is not a happy thing. So those are all things that we as a society need to think about how to approach.
Hannah Rosen is a senior editor at The Atlantic and the author of The End of Men,